From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Who controls the media? An antitrust campaign against media conglomerates.
We have an unprecedented kind of dilemma now in this country. We have basically what amounts to a trust, but it's not some raw material or essential material item that's been monopolized. It's not oil, for example. It's not beef. It's something really more important. It's the very culture itself. It's now owned and controlled by a relative handful of mammoth corporations whose only interest is in profit.
And what's happened to healthcare reform? We'll speak with Dr. Vicente Navarro. He served on Hillary Clinton's healthcare reform task force and was Jesse Jackson's advisor in 1988. We'll discuss medicine and capitalism. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Today we're broadcasting from the studios of WJHU in Baltimore. This week, two giant mergers were announced, shaking up the telecommunications and healthcare industries. Aetna wants to gobble up U.S. healthcare, a leading HMO, and two baby bills are planning to merge in a $24 billion deal. These two deals reflect some of the problems with current public policy on both healthcare and communications. Critics say the insurance companies are running and ruining healthcare in this country, and the Aetna U.S. healthcare merger only makes that relationship clearer. Also, the merger of the baby bills goes directly against the guarantees made by backers of the telecommunications bill, which promised to increase competition. Later in the show, we're going to be talking about healthcare in this country, but now we're going to the issue of media monopolization. And we're joined by a return visit of Mark Crispin Miller, professor at Johns Hopkins University and author of Boxed In, The Culture of TV. Welcome to Democracy Now! It's a pleasure to have you with us.
Nice to be back. Amy.
And also we have with us Juan Gonzalez on the phone from New York. Juan Gonzalez, a columnist with the Daily News. Juan's going to join us in conversation with Mark. But before we go to the issue of media monopolization, Juan, you had a good piece in the Daily News yesterday on the deaths of Ron Brown, Carl Stokes, and also Hayward Burns.
Well, thank you, Amy. I think that many in the media missed with all of the attention devoted to the death of Ron Brown in the plane crash in Croatia, the passing within almost a 24-hour span of two other giants of the Black movement for equality. You had Carl Stokes, the first Black mayor of a major American city, who passed away from cancer, and then of course Hayward Burns, the much loved radical attorney, who died in a car accident in South Africa, and all of them with roots in New York City to some extent. In fact, Stokes was a TV reporter with WNBC for many years after serving as mayor of Cleveland, and I think the shock to many in the African-American community of the loss of three leaders in such a short period of time, although Ron Brown had both his supporters and detractors, but he was nonetheless a pioneer as being the first African-American to lead a major political party in this country. And in the column, I tried to focus on the combined loss and the impact on the African-American community.
You also mentioned the people he brought with him to Washington, like Carol Hamilton, who is with a big union family in New York.
Yes, and in fact, I did a piece in today's paper specifically on Carol, because sometimes the big luminaries get all the attention, and Carol comes, of course, from a very distinguished family. Her father, Charles Hamilton, was the co-author with Stokely Carmichael back in 1967 of the famous book Black Power and the Politics of Liberation in America, and has always been an influential thinker and academic within the African American community. So Carol came from a very distinguished family.
And Carol Hamilton went down in the plane with Ron Brown. She was his press secretary. Well, we're going to turn now to the issue of media monopolization. And no one better to do it with than Mark Crispin Miller, who is really beginning to spearhead a movement against the well, really, the monopolization of the media. And he has a very interesting four-page chart, which we've talked about before when Mark was here, that shows who owns the media. And before we move on with some new questions, Mark, I thought it was important once again for listeners who didn't hear or couldn't digest it all when you were first here to really go through with us again the major owners of the media.
Okay, when we talk about the media in this case, it's important to point out that we're talking only about the four corporations that own the major TV news operations. For example, Rupert Murdoch's empire is not on this chart, neither is Viacom. This is a chart that shows how CBS is owned by Westinghouse, which is a major manufacturer of surveillance systems and nuclear reactors. NBC, of course, as many people know, is owned by General Electric and has been for 10 years. General Electric being the sixth largest Fortune 500 company and, of course, a major defense contractor, among other things. ABC is now owned by Disney, the fun and games behemoth, and CNN is owned by Time Warner, which is another entertainment giant with many, many different kinds of interests. What the chart strives to do is demonstrate not only the direct control of these news entities by these other larger parent companies, but also to give people some sense of the breadth of interests that these other companies have, and it also gives some slight sense of the interconnections between these four. Now, let me just add that a more detailed and even more up-to-date version of this chart will be published in The Nation in the May 1st issue. In fact, the issue will be devoted to this chart and to various attempts to unravel its many sinister implications.
And in terms of some of the principles that are critical to the individuals, because I think so often we get so lost with the names of the companies. But for instance, Warren Buffett, obviously the billionaire investor, is a key figure, is he not, in the Disney, ABC, Cap Cities empire?
Yes, he is.
Are there any other major American capitalists who are the critical, the names that people most would associate with some of these companies?
Well, there is it's an interesting question, because there are individuals, yes, but whether or not their names would register with most listeners, the answer is no.
Mm-hmm.
And the latest issue of Extra, the magazine that's published by Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting, there's a couple of pages devoted to the Capital Group, which is a ubiquitous sort of holding company that has large or considerable, owns considerable chunks of all the major media corporations. And the guy who handles their media properties is a guy named Gordon Crawford.
Mm-hmm.
It's an extremely powerful, 9% of Time Warner, for example. So he's there. Sid Bass, the Texas oil man, did own close to 20% of Cap Cities before the merger, and I've been unable so far to tell what his, continues to hold now that Disney and Cap Cities are involved. But the fact is that you're asking a good question, because there are owners of the owners.
One figure who was key until now was Lawrence Tisch, who owns CBS. And now CBS has been taken over by Westinghouse. But it brings to mind this week's piece on Frontline, which talks about the close connection between the tobacco industry. It showed the whole story behind the 60 Minutes piece, where their corporate attorneys now prevented them from running this interview, at least initially, with a Brown and Williamson vice president who was saying that his CEO had lied when he had testified before Congress and said that they don't, that nicotine is not addictive, etc. But Lawrence Tisch has been a key figure here, and he's just handed over the reins to Westinghouse. See that piece in Frontline?
Yeah, an excellent piece. Some of us, this is going to sound a little bit bitter, it's really not, but some of us have been pointing out for years that most of the, something like 84% of the revenues used to purchase CBS, I'm talking about the Tisch brothers buying it, came from P. Lorillard, their tobacco company. As the Frontline show pointed out, CBS has made them very little money. I suppose even if it were doing very well, it wouldn't have made them anywhere near as much money as P. Lorillard, which is really where, I mean, that's the cash cow for them. That's Newport Cigarettes, which for years has been the fastest rising brand in this country.
Also Vantage and True, I believe.
Vantage and True, right. But you go into any poor neighborhood and you'll see, you know, countless ads for Newport Cigarettes. Well, that's Andrew Tisch, Lawrence's son, is the CEO of P. Lorillard, and one of the CEOs just stood there lying like a rug. I mix my metaphors in Congress when they asked these guys if nicotine was addictive, and they said no. Tisch, you know, just basically bought and ruined CBS and then facilitated this merger. But his interests in tobacco, I think, have something to do with the in-house counsel's advice to the 60 Minutes people not to run the Wigand interview. You see how Byzantine this all gets.
And one of the points they made was how who's running these networks now, especially when you talk about the lawyers, they're corporate lawyers that are advising the newsrooms, and they're concerned about corporations and what makes corporations look good or bad, and that was part of the advising that went on at CBS.
Yes. Now, it's an important point to make here that, yes, there was never any golden age of television news. I mean, broadcasting has, from the get-go, been a commercial enterprise, really since the Communications Act of 1934, as Bob McChesney tells us in his excellent book. Since 1934, the industry has been essentially and necessarily commercial. So now everybody just accepts it as a given that that's so. And therefore, a TV news was never really as good as print journalism could be at its best. That's all true. However, to shoot down a critique of today's media because prior media wasn't any great shakes is to miss the point. What we see now is a kind of intensified and accelerated version, a sort of nightmare version of what we've been seeing in the past, you see. It is true that Bill Paley, founder of CBS, was a very greedy guy. He was interested in profits. But he also believed in, as much as possible, keeping his news division, the CBS News Division, the division of Edward R. Murrow and others, separated as much as possible, protected from the pressures of the market. Now, that sort of theoretical belief in the sanctity of the news has absolutely disappeared. Now the journalists are owned by these vast corporations, which are much bigger than the heads of networks. They're owned by these vast corporations just for the purposes of disseminating various kinds of corporate propaganda. They certainly don't believe that these entities are going to make them a huge profit.
Well, Mark, with the growth of these incredible trusts in the mega media and the communications industry, years ago at the beginning of the century, with the robber barons of the old giant trusts in steel and oil and so forth, they aroused much more public anger and resentment and a movement, it seems, against them than these current robber barons of the new communications wars. Why is that? Why has there not been a kind of public outcry against the growing monopolization of what is probably the most important industry that as we approach the 21st century?
That's an excellent question. Why isn't there? Why indeed isn't there? How did those earlier movements begin? They began because of the fairly well-known work of certain intrepid so-called muckraking journalists. It was Ida Tarbell, for example, whose father had been ruined in business by John D. Rockefeller's Standard Oil. Ida Tarbell went after John D. Rockefeller, and it was from McClure's Monthly Magazine. Now, the daily papers naturally would not take up this fight because they were simply too embroiled in these powerful interests to have a hand in attacking them. But there were a number of independent monthlies, liberal monthlies for the most part, but they were, you know, full of news, and they were committed to getting out certain kinds of hot stories, as any journalistic organ really ought to be. Well, that series of articles, for example, by Ida Tarbell and other similar articles by other muckraking journalists caused tremendous uproar, had influence in Congress, certainly had an effect on many, many readers. Now, by and by, J.P. Morgan and John D. Rockefeller said to each other, look, this has gone far enough. I mean, we're really taking much too much heat from these people. So they started to buy pieces of those magazines. It was as simple as that. What better way to halt this kind of abuse, they took it to be abuse, than to simply come to own enough of those magazines so that, you know, they're not going to hear it anymore. Well, what's the problem that we have now? This is the problem that we have now. There are just too few visible mainstream communications vehicles left. And now it isn't just a matter of broadcasting. We tend to concentrate on broadcasting because, you know, we're children of the television era. We're talking about all the other forms of media, even the internet, which is more and more becoming commercialized. And on which all these same companies have their sights set. People who have studied the Telecommunications Act of 1996 have noted that one of the real purposes of this act is to prepare the groundwork for these corporations to get as much out of the internet as they possibly can. I mean, we can talk about this. It's theoretically impossible to monopolize the internet, which is boundless, but it is possible to tell people, look, we want to make it easy for you to cruise the net, and we want you not to be bothered by smut on the net. So the best way for us to help you is to provide you with a server engine. Just use it, and bingo. All kinds of stuff is banished to the hinterlands. Only a few cranks and activists know about it. Everybody else, for the most part in the country, is able to cruise only the acceptable commercial sites. Anyway, the point is, people are not upset about it, because they don't know about it. And they don't know about it because it is the problem. The ownership of the media is the problem. But let me say that from my own experience over the last few months, talking to people of all kinds, not just people on the left, there is a tremendous uneasiness about the media. On the right and among sort of apolitical people, it tends to take the form of uneasiness with smuttiness, you know, profane language, a lot of blood and violence and sex in the movies. On the left, it tends to be a concern with corporate censorship, maybe with the propagation of hate speech and disgusting racial and gender stereotypes. Both sets of concerns point to the same root cause, it seems to me, which is the domination of the entire culture by people like Rupert Murdoch, you know, who just don't believe in anything but profits. You follow me?
Well, let me ask you, in terms of the telecom bill, I mean, for a... It was without a doubt the most important piece of legislation that came before the Congress.
Yes.
In the last year. And yet, until almost the very end, there was virtually no media attention to it. It was one of these stealth pieces of legislation that suddenly, of course, the lobbyists and the people in the know in Congress knew of its importance, but the general public, these very media outlets, including my own newspaper, paid almost no attention to it, so that the general public had no idea of the tremendous transformations that this bill was creating. I mean, to what degree do you think that this was a deliberate or a deliberate lack of attention to such a crucial piece of legislation?
Well, I think it was deliberate, if perhaps only half conscious. You know, we always have to avoid the suggestion that we're talking about a conscious conspiracy.
Oh yes, no, I'm not suggesting.
Right, I know you're not. Yeah. You know you're not. I know you're not. You know? But people listening might say, "Oh well, this can't be a respectable critique because it's a conspiracy theory." No, I think that, you know, it's just human nature that editors will know enough not to look too closely into matters of great moment that affect their own employers. In this case, you know, because we're talking about the corporations that tend to control not just TV broadcasting and cable and radio, but the movie business, the publishing business more and more, magazines, newspapers, you know, we have not had that sort of considerable alternative press, the highly visible alternative sources of information were simply not there. I mean, the left press did some discussion of the telecommunications bill, although I think even there they fell down a bit. But we have not seen a sufficient popular reaction because there has not yet been a movement to incite that kind of a reaction.
You're listening to Mark Crispin Miller, professor at Johns Hopkins University, author of Boxed In, The Culture of TV. When we come back, we're going to ask him about the antitrust movement he's spearheading and the cultural environment movement. You just came from a conference in St. Louis around that. Also, Juan Gonzalez is on the telephone with us, columnist with the Daily News and co-host on Democracy Now! On Monday, by the way, we're going to be talking about the immigrant beating you may have seen on video from California and how immigration politics is playing in the presidential campaign. And later in the show, we'll be talking about health care in this country. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Stay with us. You are listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show. And today we are broadcasting from the studios of WJHU in Baltimore, Maryland, which is why we're joined live by Mark Crispin Miller, who lives here and works here, a professor at Johns Hopkins University, author of Boxed In, The Culture of TV, and the forthcoming book, Spectacle, Operation Desert Storm and the Triumph of Illusions. He has a very interesting chart of media ownership in the United States, which is going to be appearing in the May 1st issue of The Nation magazine, and we're joined in New York by Juan Gonzalez, columnist with the Daily News. I'm Amy Goodman. Mark, you just came from a conference in St. Louis of hundreds of activists from around the world. Can you talk about what happened there?
Yeah, this was the Cultural Environment Movement's founding conference in St. Louis a couple of weeks ago. The Cultural Environment Movement was begun by George Gerbner, professor emeritus at the University of Pennsylvania, and renowned for his many edifying studies of violence on TV. Well, he's a very canny political operator, I guess you could say, and has a broad and noble vision of what our media ought to be doing. So out of an acute sense that something really has to be done to try to roll back these commercial forces, which are predominating not just in the United States, but globally, he has helped to found this movement whose purpose, it now appears, will be primarily to initiate a very broad-based and necessarily novel kind of antitrust movement to try whenever and wherever possible to establish some kind of democratic basis for our media culture. We were there for a weekend, many different working groups, panels, and so on. It was a terrific, really exhilarating experience.
As you try to work on this antitrust campaign, I mean, first of all, we're not talking about monopolies in the media, but oligopolies, really.
It's a completely unprecedented situation.
And so how can that be challenged? I mean, do oligopolies fall under antitrust law?
Well, no. Antitrust law is quite narrow and precise. You need a very clearly drawn, clearly focused cause of action and so on. It has mostly to do with economic competition. This is... You know, historically, Amy, antitrust movements were promoted by people with very little knowledge of the law, which makes me feel terrific because I have very little knowledge of the law. I know enough to know that antitrust law as it now stands is simply not answerable. Now, there are examples within specific culture industries of antitrust infractions. They are being fought, and I think that we in the cultural environment movement and interested listeners, anyone who's concerned about this problem, should learn more about such cases
and follow them and try to lend support. For example, the American Booksellers Association is suing the big bookstore chains and the major publishers because whenever you go into a Borders or a Barnes & Noble and you see a lot of books piled up in the middle of the floor and in the windows and so on, those books are there because Random House and Viking Penguin and so on have been paying the chains a big annual fee, which puts the independent booksellers and small publishers at a disadvantage. That's a kind of classic antitrust action. It's been going on for about a year. Out of revenge, Cy Newhouse's Random House and Viking Penguin, which is owned by the Pearson Group of Britain, are boycotting this year's ABA convention, which is unprecedented. They have a lot of clout.
American Booksellers.
American Booksellers Association. Okay, that's an example of an antitrust action that is possible. But we have to be thinking larger than simply applying extant antitrust laws to the situation. What we have to be doing now is thinking in eventual legislative terms. How can the people participate now in drafting legislation that would be the diametrical opposite to the legislation that was just passed with the telecommunications bill? Because that bill was written by the big firms themselves. I mean, they basically wrote themselves a blank check and Congress signed it, you see. What we need to do is, first of all, learn the facts of who owns the media. So I urge people to start by trying to find this information out. The first thing you can do is to get the Nation on May 1st and just take out that centerfold and tack it to your bulletin board and be aware of the strong possibility that the content on the NBC Nightly News, for example, has much to do with GE's interests. Okay, after the educational step, what's necessary, I would say, is to, you know, network, get in touch with other people, call the Cultural Environment Movement, which is headquartered in Philadelphia. They're listed. See what it might take to join up. I'm perfectly willing to talk to people.
Do they call it cultural environment?
Well, because we're talking about a movement that ought to have the same kind of moral drive and concern for survival that has always animated the environmental movement, you see. The idea there is that our culture, our cultural artifacts, the products that we all read and watch and listen to, have as potent and as deadly an effect on our environment as, you know, lead and actual physical pollutants. That's the thinking behind calling it the cultural environment.
In essence, that the major media companies are now polluting the minds of the American people and the culture in general. But let me ask you, in terms of the ability of people to when you say the major media companies identify them, what is the role of the telephone companies now and the importance of the telephone companies in relationship to the development of these media monopolies?
Well, we'll see shortly, won't we? I mean, the telecommunications bill has opened the door to a wave of further mergers that could conceivably make the ones we've just seen over this past year pale in comparison. We're going to see a great meltdown, it seems to me, of telephone companies with content providers, you know. And since they have the necessary technological infrastructure for conveying the product to us, if and when they become capable of giving themselves the programming they need, they'll be completely unassailable. So to a certain extent, I suppose we could say that a movement might even seem premature because we ain't seen nothing yet. But for that very reason, I think people have to get active. I think the left has, generally speaking, been quite remiss in keeping up on these issues, partly because the telecommunications laws are enough to make your eyes glaze over. I mean, it really is for policy wonks. But it's time now, I think, precisely because of the imminent rise of the phone companies, that we have to start to think about these issues and get cracking.
You know, I think it's very interesting that there are a number of movements that are building up heads of steam this year. Yesterday we had Lois Gibbs on, who is the head of the Citizens Clearinghouse for Hazardous Waste, and she is part of this anti-dioxin movement that's building around the country. They just had a conference of more than 500 activists in Cancer Alley, Baton Rouge, Louisiana, and they are challenging the corporations that pollute. You've got the corporate charter movement, the movement that is challenging the laws that allow corporations to work the way they do, saying it's not illegal. It's not what they do that's illegal that's outrageous. It's what they do that's legal that's outrageous, and the laws should change. And you've got this antitrust movement challenging media conglomerates, and none of these movements seem to be hitting the TV radar screens. They're all below it. And of course, I think that they're aware of it. The media is aware of it, but they're challenging their sources of sustenance. They're challenging the advertisers. They're challenging those that own them. We're not just talking advertisers.
That's right. That's absolutely right. I mean, this demonstrates an important fact, and this is something I like to tell the left whenever I'm with people on the left. This is not just another issue. You know, when you get right down to it, this is the primary issue. I'm not saying it's morally the most important. I'm not saying it's worse than racism, for example. I'm saying it's primary because left activism has tended to be based on the presumption that there will always be some way we can get something on the news. You know, if we organize correctly, if we have the right kind of event, the right kind of contacts, if we're savvy, if we're canny, if we do a version of what Ed Rollins does, for example, we can get on the news. Well, that's not going to be the case anymore. You know, the system is closing down. You can hear the iron bars clang as the system closes down. It's not going to be permeable by any of our messages.
You know, one of the things that I recall I was very struck by when Professor Gerbner made his presentation at the Media and Democracy Conference in San Francisco was he talked about how in previous decades, the average child, when he or she entered public school, had basically their social values shaped by their parents and their family and their community, that today the average child who enters a public school has had his or her, who comes into kindergarten, has already had his or her values shaped by Disney Company and Time Warner and by men, as you said before, who nobody knows and nobody elected, but who wield enormous power in terms of shaping through television and through the mass media and the movies, the social values of the American people. What seems to me to be the problem in terms of being able to reach large numbers of people and get them angry is a sense of really getting to the emotional and social core of what is being done to the country by these companies. Because frankly, to tell you the truth, my colleagues whether at the Daily News or the other major newspapers are almost in awe of these giants of the Ted Turners and the Levines and the John Malones. They're in awe of the empires that these guys are building, and they're very unlikely to take them on, even right. In terms of normal reporting.
Right. No, absolutely. The power is awesome. Let's face it. Power has always been awesome, and now it's especially awesome because it's global. I'm going to say very quickly, what we have to do is demonstrate the connection between the degeneration of media content in many ways, the schlockiness, the sleaze, as well as the suppressed news. We have to demonstrate the connection between the poor quality of the cultural product on the one hand and the dominance of these few commercial entities on the other. There is a close connection. If we can demonstrate that to broad numbers of American people, I am confident that we will have a lot of popular support for an antitrust movement.
Mark and Juan, I want to thank you very much for joining us. And Mark, can you give us your phone number, your email address, if people want to get in touch with you?
Okay, if people have any ideas, you know, about this whole question of antitrust, which, as I say, is something that has to be worked out democratically, I'd love to hear from them. My email address is mcm@pobox.com. And my number at Hopkins is 410-516-5275.
That's 410-516-5275. We want to thank you very much for joining us, Mark Crispin Miller, professor at Johns Hopkins University, author of Boxed In, The Culture of TV, and the forthcoming book, Spectacle, Operation Desert Storm and the Triumph of Illusions. And Juan Gonzalez of the Daily News, my co-host here on Democracy Now!, thanks for being with us.
Okay.
Coming up next, we're going to be talking about healthcare in America. You're listening to Democracy Now! You're listening to Democracy Now! I am Amy Goodman. Healthcare now seems to be out of the media spotlight, though it continues to be one of the major concerns of Americans. I think it once again illustrates the point that the media very much follows the agenda set by Washington. Since the Clintons weren't able to get their healthcare bill passed, the president doesn't want to talk about the issue much, and so neither does the media. But what has happened? Is all hope of healthcare reform dead? Well, we're here and joined in JHU, the radio station in Baltimore, the radio stations of Johns Hopkins University, by another Johns Hopkins professor. And he is Dr. Vicente Navarro, professor of health policy, sociology, and policy studies at Johns Hopkins University. He's also founder and editor-in-chief of the International Journal of Health Services, one of the most widely circulated journals of health policy. And he's chair of the National Health Commission of the National Rainbow Coalition and was the senior health advisor to Reverend Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign. He was also invited by Hillary Rodham Clinton to serve on the National Healthcare Reform Task Force, which he did in 1993. And he was cited by the U.S. government as one of the Hispanic Americans who's contributed most to the health of all Americans. And we're honored to have you here on Democracy Now!, Dr. Navarro.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask you that question about healthcare reform. Is it dead, do you think, in this country?
Yes, I'm afraid to say so. There are some positive steps that have been taken, but very small and dramatically insufficient. I think we're not going to have a healthcare reform without a profound political reform in the country. As long as we have the enormous power that, let's say, insurance companies have in the healthcare sector and the enormous influence they have on the political Congress, on the Congress of the United States, I don't think we're going to have profound reform. So health reform needs to be preceded by a profound political reform.
And what is that profound political reform?
Well, money stops being the milk of American politics. I think that at this point, if we analyze what is the root of the problem, is the enormous power of insurance companies who are now taking over the healthcare sector. And these insurance companies send millions of dollars, just last year, $10 million, to key members of the Congress, like Gingrich, is very much in the pocket of the insurance companies, but also Democrats like Gebhardt gets also a lot of money from the insurance companies, and they have enormous influence in stopping, shaping, and making the nature of legislation. An example is the last proposal for so-called reform approved by the House that is a Christmas tree for the insurance companies. And that is what is happening. I think that when the founders of the United States, in that splendid document called the Constitution, says we the people, they didn't put a footnote and insurance companies and the pharmaceutical industries and the medical profession. Frankly, we the people, the American public, do not decide much on what happened to Congress of the United States, at least in the health sector.
What about that health care legislation that passed the House? What did it say?
Well, it's basically, as I mentioned, a Christmas tree for the insurance companies. It, for example, it caps the malpractice awards. So if your doctor cuts you the wrong leg, you only get at most a quarter of a million. Well, that is dramatically insufficient. That is just one example. Then also try to increase the savings accounts to provide your own insurance through your own savings, which is a very handsome gift to the banking industry, since they are the one recipients of those savings. And insurance and banking in this country are closely interconnected. This power is what is at the root of the problem in the healthcare sector.
What about legislation that's currently before the Senate, the Kennedy-Cassebaum bill? You've got Senator Ed Kennedy, a liberal Democrat from Massachusetts, and you've got the Republican Nancy Kassebaum of Kansas that have joined together in this legislation. What does it do? What do you think of it?
Well, it is a positive step. I think it's much better than the House, and in that respect, it could help some people, but it's dramatically insufficient. We had to realize that the major problems we have in the healthcare of this country are problems that affect millions and millions and millions of people. For example, 42 million Americans do not have any formal coverage whatsoever. This proposal is not going to affect much, these 40 million people. Another problem, the majority of people who have coverage do not have comprehensive coverage. Even I, Professor Hopkins, who must have one of the best health benefit coverage, I do not have long-term care. The majority of Americans do not have long-term care. And they are not aware, by the way. The polls show that they are not aware of that. Well, they will not be able to afford long-term care if they need it. The average cost is $25,000 per year. They cannot. The medium income for an American family is $32,000. Now, this reform does not touch on that either. So after the bill will be approved, still the majority of Americans will not have comprehensive coverage. Another problem is that the system of funding healthcare in the United States is extremely regressive. Just to give you an idea, the person who makes more money in this country is someone by the name of Mr. Fried. He is the chief executive officer of one of the major hospital corporations. And he makes $128 million a year. And he pays the same premium to get the health benefit coverage for him and his family that the average employee of his company, which makes approximately $22,000, one makes $128 million, the other $22, and they pay the same amount of premium. This law does not touch on that. So we have a major profound problems that call for major reforms, and these reforms have been put forward either in the House, which is a cop-out, or in the Senate, which could be a positive step, but dramatically insufficient, do not touch on the roots of the problem.
We're talking to Dr. Vicente Navarro, who is a professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University. You're listening to Democracy Now! We're going to be talking about how health care in this country compares to other countries after this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica Radio's daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman, and I'm joined by Dr. Vicente Navarro, who is a professor of health policy at Johns Hopkins University, author of more than a dozen books. His latest book is The Politics of Health Policy, the U.S. Reforms, 1980 to 1994. He's also author of Dangerous to Your Health, Capitalism in Healthcare. Well, let's talk about the state of the health of the American people, Dr. Navarro.
Well, it's not a very good shape, actually. In spite of being the country that we spend more on healthcare than any other country, we spend 14% of the GNP on healthcare, we still have very poor health indicators. And a point that needs to be said is they are getting worse. People are not aware of that. But mortality has been increasing rather than declining. And that in 1993, the CDC, which is the major federal agency,
Centers for Disease Control,
that keeps the information about the state of Americans, has informed, and that has not been widely published, that the mortality is increasing and life expectancy is declining, the first time since 1980. So mortality rates are increasing, and that is a point that is extremely worrisome, and that means that people are suffering. I think that when I said before that 42 million Americans do not have any form of coverage, this means that every year 100,000 Americans die because of lack of coverage. That is three times the amount of people who die because of AIDS. Now, a lot of visibility, the AIDS issue, and that is good. I think that people should be aware we have a major problem. But not much has been written or said about the three times as many people die because of lack of coverage. And that is because of the problems I was raising before.
How do we compare internationally?
Bad. I think that in that respect, in terms of infant mortality, at this point we're number 22. We should establish a
league. Say that number again.
22. 22 other countries have better infant mortality than the United States. I think that is outrageous. The wealthiest country in the world. And I want to stress that the problem in the healthcare is not that we do not spend enough or that we cannot afford it. That is ridiculous. We are the wealthiest country in the world. We could afford providing a very good comprehensive coverage like the Canadians do. And the Canadians spend far less than we do. So it's not money. That is what the Congress will tell you. It's the control of that money. That is the issue. The control of that money by this huge insurance companies who are now controlling the managed care companies, and they put profit about human needs. This is the root of the problem.
Well, let me ask you something. I mean, Hillary Rodham Clinton invited you to be on the National Health Care Reform Task Force. You served on that. That was the task force that was shaping the bill that they introduced. They certainly didn't do away with insurance companies. What was your role in it? You clearly are an advocate of single payer. How seriously were you taken?
I was not taken seriously. I was a token. I never quite find out where I was, the token radical, the token Hispanic, or what. But certainly I was completely irrelevant in that. And I was asked to serve because Jesse Jackson and I went to speak with Mrs. Clinton and complained that the Democratic Party was exclusive of the single-payer proponents. And they make an extremely important wrong decision to choose the managed care, which was the insurance company model. So Clinton, in spite of what he claimed to be anti-insurance, was in the pocket of the large insurance companies.
So,
and the managed care was that. Now, when Jesse Jackson complained, then Ms. Clinton said, well, join in, and at least I was able to find out what was going on. But the problem with Clinton is he never dared to question the power of the large insurance.
Let me ask you, there were a lot of advertisements around that time showing what would happen if the health care bill was passed that was presented by the Clintons. What about today? Has the things, if this bill was passed, would things have been any different than they are today? In fact, I mean, one of the things they said is everyone's going to be forced to go into HMOs, for example, and yet people are being forced to go into HMOs all over this country.
Right. Let me stress, because there's a lot of confusion, how is it that insurance companies were criticizing the Clinton and how that matches with my statement that Clinton was in the pocket of the large insurance? Well, the large insurance, they are the large insurance, which is the top 10 control already more than 50% of the premium market, and then there are the small insurance, which basically is peanuts in terms of power. But they are very visible, and they were the ones who mobilized the TV ads. And for them, the Clinton proposal had been their elimination. So the large insurance were against the small insurance, and the small insurance were the ones who were against Clinton. But the large insurance were not against the Clinton proposal. I want to stress that, because a lot of confusion has been created on that.
Because they would have stayed, and the smaller ones would have been put out of business.
Right, and where the small insurance companies, the ones who basically control Health Insurance Association of America, who ran those ads. So that needs to be clarified. The Clinton administration was not anti-insurance.
You know, we're talking about simple payer rather glibly here. What exactly is single payer? We know in Congress there were more supporters of single payer than any other plan, and yet the media hardly covered it. When we say Canada, for example, or Britain, what do you mean?
Well, just to give you an idea of how biased the media is, just yesterday I was reading one of the major dailies on health policy issues called Healthline that appears from Washington and referred to the single payer as Soviet medicine. Now, it's quite remarkable because what we're asking is what the members of the Congress of the United States already have. So if they had Soviet medicine, then we want the majority of Americans to have Soviet medicine. It's outrageous that Senator Dole, who is benefiting from the system of federal funded comprehensive coverage, accuses that of socialist medicine. Well, if what Senator Dole wants, we want it for all of us, all the Americans. So it's outrageous when you see people like Gingrich and people like Dole criticizing socialist medicine when they're benefiting from that. They should renounce, if they are honest and decent, they should renounce their benefits. Just to be a minimum of certain intellectual coherence in what they are saying. Now, Single pay is what the majority of other developed industrialized nations like Western Europe and Canada already have. So the federal government pays for and contracts with the private sector for the delivery of services. But by the federal government being the one who pays for, then can establish the basis on which to reimburse the providers. So in that respect, that is what happened all over Europe, and also actually the United States is the exception. We are the only country where the funding is private and is controlled by the insurance companies, where profit is the primary motor of the system. Now, profit and human need do not necessarily coincide, and even insurance company in managed care has to choose between profit or serving the patients is quite obvious what they are going to do, and that is what they are doing. We can see constantly in the media how patients are dropped out, how certain chronic conditions are being excluded. All that is to put profit before human need. So what we are asking in favor of single payer is just joining the community of civilized nations and guarantee the provision of health care is a basic human right.
You're listening to Dr. Vicente Navarro, who is the leading progressive authority on health care in this country and author of The Politics of Health Policy. Dr. Sid Wolf of Public Citizen has said that the only way single payer is going to come to this country is by states. One state is not going to take it anymore, and it's going to pass single payer, and that it will happen like that, state by state, rather than at the congressional level. Do you agree with that assessment? Do you think it'll ever come to this country?
Oh, it will come, there's no question. There's no question. I think that we cannot be outside history. I think that if all our countries have it, and with at a lower cost provides comprehensive coverage, at the end that will be put forward. The problem is the media, as your previous speaker outlined, we cannot present to the public that message. Imagine referring to single payer as Soviet medicine. It's ridiculous. But that is how our media appears. And you see very few reports that are clearly objective about the coverage of healthcare in other countries. You don't see a fair, objective, rigorous analysis of what happened in the British healthcare system, in the French, in the Canadian. Ours, when those systems are presented, are put down. But meanwhile, the citizens of those countries have all the benefits coverage, and meanwhile, we do not have a comprehensive coverage.
What is your assessment this week of one of the giant mergers that was announced, and that was Aetna Insurance taking over U.S. healthcare? What does that mean?
Well, it's what I was saying before. I think the insurance companies are taking the provision of healthcare, and they are developing forms that are called managed care. So what we have now in this country is the provision of health care given through managed care companies who are controlled by insurance companies. And we have Aetna taking over health care. And 28 million Americans then are from now on under the control of the Aetna, one of the largest insurance companies in this country. Now, what happened, by the way, in that is that the chief executive officer who was responsible for that transaction got $900 million out of that transaction. Now, this means people's money. These $900 million that were pocketed by this individual, that is premium money. That is what you and I and the average American pays for that. So that is outrageous, the amount of profits that have been made in the healthcare sector. Now, I ask you, if Aetna has to choose between the needs of the patients, all the profits they are going to make, what they are going to choose? It's obvious. Do we want to put profit as the major force to change the nature of a system that is primarily aimed at responding to human needs? This is suicidal. It's ridiculous what is happening here.
Dr. Navarro, at the beginning of this conversation, you said that we can't change healthcare until we change politics in this country. What do you think needs to be done?
Well, I have been at Hopkins 30 years and involved in many active and social movements, and it seems to me that it's terribly important that the people who are involved in different issues, who are involved on healthcare, others might be protecting the environment, others might be on civil rights, others might be in promoting women's rights, etc., etc. It's terribly important that we realize that we have far more things in common. They're not things that separate us. I think the other side, corporate America, is extremely powerful. They control the two parties. And they have enormous influence on the media. They control the press. Meanwhile, we are split. We are divided in different social movements. And that is the root of our problem. I think that the progressive force in this country need to get united, need to establish a new political force on which the labor will have to play an important role, but not the only, an exclusive role. There will also be social movements that around and presenting an alternative to this huge, overwhelming concentration of power we have in the United States. I think the two major political parties of this country do not represent the majority of the American population. And I think that what we need is to try to mobilize the population around their own political instrument that might help and relate the different elements that exist. This is the major difference between Europe and the United States. In the United States, we have a very strong environmental movement, but our environment is less protected than Europe. Now, we have very strong elderly population movement. We have American Association of Retired People, very strong. But our elderly have less health benefit coverage than not in Europe. Now, we have all type of issues. We have a social movement. But we have less rights than other countries, where they have less single issues and they have a strong social democratic parties, labor parties, or whatever progressive parties you might think of. And that is what we need in this country, to develop a labor social democratic party that can be inclusive in terms of other elements besides labor and that can present an alternative to this enormous power and control they have.
Do you see it happening? I mean, there are the Greens out there. They are now putting forward Ralph Nader as a presidential candidate. There's the New Party out there. Do you see these in any way evolving to what you have in Europe?
Yeah, well, you should have mentioned also Labour Party. I think that, I do think that hopefully all these different groups, the Labour Party, the New Party, the Green Party, or whatever party we might still have around, will realize that it's terribly important to establish a coalition force to present an alternative to the enormous dominance of corporate America in this country. That is the most urgent demand. So single payer, fine, but those who are involved in single payer need to realize that the problem is a political one. Those involved in trying to protect the environment, they had to realize that the problem is a political one. Congress, what I said before, we the people, there's a lot of footnotes there that are diluting the message of we the people. I think there is the most urgent demand from a health point of view in this country is to recover the sense that the government of this country is run for, by, and of the people.
Where do you see the current healthcare system in this country going right now?
Oh, I think that the completely uninhibited takeover of all the dimensions of healthcare by the insurance companies. They are, at this point, they are taking over. I think they are converting physicians in mere employees of these insurance companies, curtailing their practices, commanding them what they are supposed to do, interfering in the physician-patient relationship. That is what's happening. And at this point, it is without any form of restraint. And that, unless there is resistance and forcing the Congress to become far more sensitive and responsible to the average citizen, at this point, the Congress of the United States is clearly under enormous influence of these insurance companies.
Dr. Vicente Navarro, I want to thank you very much for joining us. Again, Dr. Navarro is Professor of Health Policy, Sociology, and Policy Studies at Johns Hopkins University, was the health advisor to Jesse Jackson's 1988 presidential campaign, served on Hillary Rodham Clinton's National Health Care Reform Task Force, and is the author of The Politics of Health Policy, U.S. Reforms, 1980 to 1994, and also Dangerous to Your Health, Capitalism in Healthcare. Thank you for being with us on Democracy Now!
Thank you.
Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin with assistance from Pat Greenfield. It was engineered by Chris Zay here in the studios of WJHU in Baltimore. Our musical consultant has been Bernard White. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. Join us on Monday for another edition of Democracy Now! When we'll be talking about immigration politics and talking about that videotape of the beating in California of two immigrants. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.